Welcome to Sapphic Survival Guide, where we are queer to answer your questions. My name is Cheyenne.
And I'm Gina.
And class is now in session. We have another guest with us today. Fazila, can you introduce yourself to everyone?
My name is Fazila Siddiqui. I use she, her pronouns. See, I'm a lot of things. I'm a storyteller, a community builder. For the past 10 years, I've been a lawyer, a movement lawyer. Now I'm a professor and I teach critical race and gender studies, although I did actually learn critical race theory in law school. So this is actually based off the real thing, you know. And I am the kind of founding editor of PR to the People. PR means love in Urdu and Hindi. And it's essentially a take on power to the people. I'm also, I call myself a Sufi witch because it feels the most authentic to me. I'm a queer Muslim. I'm first generation in this country. I don't know, all the stuff.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about your queer journey and your experience?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. First of all, I was raised in Buffalo, but I live in Brooklyn right now. You know, I think it all started when I was 8 and I was in Arabic school. And I remember being like, married, had sex, you know, like I got kicked out. I was like, Mary was totally having sex. I was 8. You know, my mom had to beg to get me back in, but because, you know, and I don't know if you know, like in Islam, the Old Testament is 100% part of the religion, and same with the Torah. And so, you know, the same story about immaculate conception, etc., is what Muslims believe. You know, I remember, oh my gosh, I just remember playing boyfriend girlfriend with a lot of little girls back then. But you know, honestly, you know, I was raised in that whole like double life that so many first gen, we've seen it, we've heard it, we know what that is. But I think it was really when I was 25 and I had started my master's in social work at the University of Michigan. And there was kind of this like motley crew of queer Muslims. And for the first time, I was like, ta-da, you know, like, this is it, you know, because it's such a nuanced space to be in because of the kind of external gaze, but then also internally. And, you know, a lot of white gay spaces just never felt right to me. There was so much kind of like white liberalism, which is like white liberal racism. And I just, you know, I remember there was a club at one of my schools and I walked past and it was like all white faces. And I was like, nope, it was like a queer club, you know? And I was just like, nope, because sometimes those spaces are like the most lonely, you know? And I think that like with just the culture, September 11th, all of it, I actually have held on more to my Muslim identity, right? That's been essentially, I mean, let's talk about intersectionality, right? It's like, it's hard to place one or the other, but it's a very unique space.
Yeah. Yeah. We talk a lot on this podcast about if you can't find like a space for yourself, about creating your own. And it sounds kind of like that queer Muslim community was kind of your group of people's way of creating that own space. So I love that.
Yeah. And like, it just feels like we're really, really building. For example, one of my roommates during my master's, Shanaz, she's the ED of Queer Crescent, which is like a healing justice org for queer Muslims. One of my chosen families, Rafa, down the hall, started, you know, Queer Muslims for Palestine, where we did a large event at Stonewall, you know, to kind of take back the narrative about what's happening and the pink washing and the homo nationalism that is just, you know, so prevalent right now. So I feel like we're building and it's really exciting, and I feel very privileged to be in Brooklyn, right? Because it's like Brooklyn and Oakland, there's very few spaces that have such an abundance of this identity and community. And yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, we started through Queer Crescent, we started a queer Muslim parenting group, you know, and that was really amazing. And has been just building community that way. So yeah, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it definitely does. What's something, that you would say was unexpected for you that came up as a queer parent?
There is something quite specific because my mm-hmm. kid, my son, S-U-N, he goes by he and they pronouns, by the way, he's seven. At school, they were doing this like assignment on snowmen, and it was hanging on the outdoor, like wall, outdoor area. And I saw his, and he crossed out man and put snow people. Or like he'll come home and say, like, someone in my class said dolls are only for girls, but I told them that, like, you know, gender's a construct.
Yes.
And so, like, I just feel like there's a lot of joy and liberation in parenting, you know, and one of my, again, chosen family lives down the hall, and they have a kid. And so we're trying to raise our kids in a way that just doesn't lose the beautiful parts of our culture and background and what we are raised in, but also allows us to be authentically Muslim and queer and practicing as ever in whatever way we choose to.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm not gonna lie, I did tear up a little bit listening to you talk. Like, that's so beautiful. So I'm a Cancer, so I'm like,
oh my gosh, oh my gosh, I cannot believe I forgot my. I literally pulled the tarot right before from my favorite tarot deck. I like did the whole spread. I got the Seven of Wands. I am a Leo sun,
okay,
Scorpio moon, and a Sagittarius rising. So I've double fire, a little water.
I could see that for you. Love. Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
I can't believe I forgot that. Oh my gosh.
It's okay. That's okay. I'm glad that reminded you. Yeah, I'm glad it reminded you.
Well, since you had mentioned before the event you were doing at Stonewall and just how you were supporting Palestine and the Muslim community, can you just tell us more about that? And of course, if there's any action our listeners can take or we can take, we'd love to hear that.
Oh my gosh, so many actions. Like, that's a hard question. I feel like I need to send you everything. For the purposes of this podcast, I think it's really important to talk about kind of the narrative about queer Muslims and queer Palestinians, because if you like literally just do a sample, just like watch 20 to 30 videos from Zionists trying to justify apartheid, occupation, and genocide. And one of the first things they'll say is, are you okay with gay people? And someone will say yes, and they'll say, well, why don't you support Palestine, right? And that is very much something called pinkwashing, which is essentially the colonizing mission of today, the civilizing mission, right? Where it's the same thing that happened to indigenous people, that they use the savage trope, the terrorist trope, right? The monster trope. We remember around October 7th, right? Netanyahu was saying, oh, they're animals, right? We've seen this all over in this country, to indigenous folks, to Black folks. I mean, this is a common occurrence. But right now, with what pinkwashing does, is it essentially uses LGBTQ identities to prove, like, support of LGBTQ rights, to kind of justify neoliberalism and democracy, although it's just a ruse, because in the background, there is, you know, the violence is happening, etc. And so these two things are happening simultaneously, and Israel has been doing this, except there's like no gay marriage in Israel. You can't have interfaith marriage in Israel. You know, it's a strategy and a tactic. So what we've been doing, is we've changed the narrative, really, in that a bunch of us have kind of organized in person or online and met. And, you know, we have been providing spaces, like on my Instagram, et cetera, on various other Instagrams, of the needs of queer Palestinians within Palestine. And there are queer trans folks in Palestine, right? And those who are here. And just stating that we are here, we are queer, we all exist. And, you know, also the term gay, right, is also often viewed as a colonial word. And so around the world, you know, the way people are in their sexuality is very different also than in the West. So even like the coming out trope and all of that, you know, there's a book right now called Hijab Butch Blues, which I highly recommend.
So good.
It's been recommended to us before too.
I really related to that in so many ways. So we've just been, you know, this event at Stonewall, I actually recited the Adhan, and it's kind of been like my dream to do it, because I used to like sing it in opera, and my mom was like, haram, haram, and my dad was like, do it, you know. But my friend who was organizing came over, and they were like, we need you to do the Adhan. And, you know, women don't usually do the Adhan, you know, and so I was like, okay. It was awesome. We had this amazing khutbah. Khutbah is kind of the, I guess you could say, sermon, you know, by Rend. And who else? Oh, there's so many others, but it was just, oh my gosh, we were at Stonewall. We were praying together. We had folks bearing witness, and it was like, I'm so happy it's happening at Stonewall, because Stonewall has been, you know, appropriated so in so many ways. So it just felt like just a really beautiful event, and there was a lot of press on it, et cetera, et cetera. So, and since that time, it's just, I think it's very clear that we are here, and we're just disrupting that narrative.
Yeah. Yeah,
you're that definitely is doing, really beautiful.
Doing good work. Yeah, I love that. Another question I pulled for you, what you're just talking about made me think of it. We had someone ask how to like affirm their gender identity when your native language doesn't have the words to. And since you were kind of just talking about like gay being a colonial term, and you know, people identifying all these different ways, I was wondering if you had any insight on affirming identity when like the language.
You know, it's so funny that you say that, because we were once trying to figure out like a gender expansive term for beta or beti in Urdu. We're like, bete, betex? Like what? How do we figure this out? And it's absolutely an emergent, you know, issue, I guess. Maybe it's not emergent, right? Because folks have been inventing language forever. I always teach my students, or tell my students, that language is power, right? And the change of language is also power. And law is simply the language of power. And so, you know, the way a lot of these terms change, like I very much view myself as part of the queer movement and not part of the LGBTQ movement, which is like GLAAD, Human Rights Campaign. I very much see these as separate movements, you know? And so, I just bantered on. This is actually so much fun, because I'm so used to doing like professional interviews like this, and you have to be so, you know, like tight with everything.
Right.
Like a lawyer.
We're a little more loosey-goosey. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, we love to hear the like ranting and stuff ourselves. So totally keep doing it.
Actually, you know, when I was talking about when I was 25 and met all these folks at University of Michigan, I think what's really important to talk about here is like just a couple of years before that, I had an abortion, blah, blah, blah. And it was there that I was one of these folks that I had met was just like, well, you know, all the aunties do it. And I was like, what? Like, you know, this is at the time that I was still using the term pro-choice, which I don't use anymore. And I was just like, my mind was blown. And then I realized it's true. And like, even I don't actually really talk about the Prophet Muhammad. That's not part of my spirituality necessarily, which people would say, then you're not Muslim, whatever. Okay. Anyways, so, but the Prophet Muhammad says up to the 120th day, which is the third trimester, is when the ruh is blown in, which is like the soul, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I was Yeah. And so, and there's a lot of amazing Muslim repro spaces, Heart Women and Girls, Queer Crescent, which I told you about. My friend is the head of the Repro Justice Legal Defense Fund, also part of this kind of like queer Muslim repro network. But anyways, it was interesting because I was in Afghanistan and Pakistan for my old job. It was this Muslim Women's Justice Equity, you know, organization. And when I was in Pakistan, all these folks at dinner were like, oh, I had an abortion, I had an abortion, I had an abortion. And then we were in Afghanistan and, or not we, I was the only person. That's a whole other thing. But I was staying in the home of the ED of this organization that we worked with. And, you know, we were going out and we were also talking about abortion there. And the issue there was that folks had to figure out how to get to India. Because due to the occupation of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, there was no healthcare in Afghanistan, right? So this is where we have the issues with imperial feminism, carceral feminism, neoliberal feminism, like the Hillary Clintons of the world, the Amy Schumers of the world. You know what I mean? Like these folks are extremely problematic. And so because there's just such a blind spot, just like a misunderstanding, which is look at what's happening with the repro justice world right now. There's such a fissure around Palestine, you know?
What word do you use since you said you don't use pro-choice anymore? Just, I'm curious.
Yeah, I was going to ask that too. And well, why, if you could explain.
Yeah, there's a whole article, two articles actually on the website. So you can go into, they go into detail. But actually, when I was doing my master's, there was this professor, her name's Professor Stoller, and she had been a lawyer, PhD in child, houseless children, something like that. She was like brilliant in many ways. And there was a course called Social Work and the Law. And at this point, it was like, the war in Iraq was happening. We were all still protesting, you know, because my community knew there was no WMDs. I was like on the street organizing. This is when I really like cut my teeth on organizing and for like pro-choice abortion issues. And she had me write 10 pages against Roe v. Wade. Okay. I was pissed, but then I realized how Roe v. Wade is actually a terrible decision. I shouldn't say terrible because we want to preserve it for whatever, but it it was based on this penumbra of rights, which is not actually in the Constitution, which is why conservatives could cut away at it. And it was based on privacy versus equality, et cetera, et cetera. Essentially, in 1980, there was another case called Harris v. McRae, which is where the Hyde Amendment is. Most people don't realize that a lot of Black, Indigenous, low-income folk, women and femmes, lost their right to choose in 1980, right? So this idea of choice is the whole movement was organized by and for mid to upper class white women. And they actually created an alliance with white women in the South who actually flipped on them. They didn't create alliances with women of color, right? And that is where the reproductive justice movement was created. It was actually 12 Black women, Loretta Ross, et cetera, in a hotel room in Chicago. And they had just come back from a conference in Cairo. So they were like bringing in international human rights principles into this new reproductive justice movement, different than the reproductive rights movement. And the person that they were protesting at that conference was the keynote speaker, and that was Hillary Clinton. And so the reproductive justice movement was really, you know, kind of in protest to BIPOC femmes and women saying we're not going to keep sacrificing our rights. But anyways, the details are, there's a lot of kind of details, legalese, etc. But yes, I'm absolutely for 100% for bodily autonomy, absolutely. But not just, you know, for trans folks, because you know, trans justice right now, what's happening is like, it's every community is under attack. Right. And so absolutely. It's just that phrase. And again, it's just, like I said, like the law is just a language of power, which a professor of mine really put, like a social justice class professor really put in my head. But actually that's why I went to law school, because they had just passed the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Act in 2007. And so I was like, oh, I'm never going to be a corporate lawyer. So I can do this and my loans will be forgiven. And they were forgiven last year. And it was amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I just want to say your students are very lucky because I'm like getting chills listening to you talk. So yeah, I'm sure they love it.
A lot of like my training, which is like organizing, social work, law, like all these things, disjointed things, I think about these systems together, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose of PR is to use critical race and gender studies, but incorporating what bell hooks said, right, is that with respect to race, gender, and class, popular culture is where the pedagogy is. It's where the learning is at for the people, right? So I'm trying to figure out how folks can have more access to kind of liberatory education, because it is very elite to have to go to college.
Yeah.
Expensive, right?
Yeah.
So that's my that's my goal with this whole site slash Instagram. But it's just been a passion project. I need more time.
When you were just talking, I was like, wow, I should go to grad school. Like, I really then I'd have to finish my undergrad degree because I don't have a degree. So I literally inaccessible when
it's inaccessible.
You have all these barriers. Yeah.
And
so.
You know, like, and every time I'm teaching a class, I literally see students like jump in their seat, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's because we're taught lie after lie after lie to keep up white supremacy culture alive, right? Mm-hmm. And we're all taught that. We all swim in it. And so really kind of decolonizing our minds is important. But like, you know, 2043 is right around the corner. And as we see the demographics shift, right, that's when we will no longer be a majority white country. And so there's a lot happening with regard to race and gender. You know, so how black and brown bodies are used to further white supremacy. I mean, this is where it's going to get really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I love it.
Well,
do you typically, or I guess in your history, do you typically date within the queer Muslim community, or have you had, since you'd mentioned the interfaith relationships weren't always allowed in, I think it was Israel you'd said, but have you only dated within queer Muslim community, or?
So right now I just feel so aligned with queer Muslims because of the moment we're in, and it just feels so safe and like family, but also just seen, and you know, seen in somatic ways that don't use our thought or our words or our minds, but our feelings and kind of the energies around us. And I very much feel like I always have to stay queer Muslim, right? And so yeah, like it's the space I'm in, and of course attractions are going to happen, but yeah, before in my life it wasn't like this. It was, I think there was a lot of trying to fit in other spaces and not just be like able to be really Muslim, although I'm not really Muslim. I mean, like, I do practice in my own way, right?
It's whatever it means to you,
your own version of it.
Not in the kind of interpretation that's like, you know, fundamentalist and right wing. Exactly. But I feel like it's becoming really important to me to make sure that like that is centered in relationships moving forward, specifically again because of this time. Like, I've dated people before, and if it comes to politics, like my gut, my stomach will just be like, done. Like it's like that, done. And so yeah, politics really matter, right? I'm an abolitionist. If someone is thinking that, you know, I don't know, that we shouldn't abolish prisons, that we shouldn't abolish cops, like, I don't think we would have similar values in life anymore, right? If someone is like pro, you know, Zionism, the occupation, which is obviously very separate than Judaism, I'm just not gonna, you know, but it doesn't mean that those people are only queer Muslims, by the way. There's like a lot of folks that are not that. But I think that because this community is building and getting stronger and bigger, and we're all kind of meeting each other really through the internet, because it's like, you know, folks are spread everywhere. It's definitely enticing.
Yeah, and identity is so layered that I feel like intersectionality can play such a key factor in relationships, that when you find like community, I imagine that that's just such a like peace kind of moment. So
yeah, it feels like home, you know.
Home
that, but home that you've never felt before, like the home you dreamt could be home, right?
Yeah,
home is with people. Home, I don't believe home is a structure, and so
yeah,
you know, that's why I don't know, it's just, I think it's just so awesome. I don't know. It's just like, whoa, dreams are actually coming true, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So do you have any advice for making like an interfaith relationship work long term? Is there anything that came up for you that like you would or wouldn't do again?
I haven't had necessarily issues with interfaith at all, right? Because I believe kind of like that Sufi saying that it's just, you know, one, it's just like different lights, but the same structure.
Yeah.
And I am pulled to folks who are spiritual. And so it's like, you know,
they get it.
I'm open to, I've always been open to folks of other religions, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know what it felt like to meet like queer Muslims and just have this other connection that you're just like, whoa, right? Mm-hmm. Even as chosen family, friends, etc. It's just, that's unique and different, but it also, again, doesn't mean that like I have to be in an eros relationship with that person, you know?
Do you think there's any common misconceptions about any queer sector of people in the media, or whether it relates to, you know, queer Muslims or not, just queer misrepresentation that's out there?
So many misconceptions. Well, first of all, I just want to flag Sort Of. You all know about HBO Sort Of, right?
I don't know.
Okay. It's an amazing, amazing show. Wait, is it Sort Of Bilal? Just HBO Sort Of Bilal, I think. I should look it up. But it's so good. It's a trans Muslim protagonist, and it's just, it's
very, Sort Of.
Sort Of, right. It is so good.
Yeah. There's three seasons, so that's going right on my list.
I can't wait to hear what you think about it. I'm like thinking of when I talk critical gender studies last semester. On the board, on the right side, I put LGBTQ, the left side, queer, right? Because LGBTQ, the T is really just ignored, right? And it's like, it's very much like the rich, white, gay man, HRC, hegemony that colors that, right? And it's centered in neoliberalism, like the focus on marriage in order to get benefits, whereas so many like queer folks don't want marriage, want to destroy that structure, right? That's not the point. So on that, the other side is the queer movement, right? Which is much more heavily composed of like BIPOC folks, again, because of all the coming out memes and such, because there's so much white supremacy in the LGBTQ movement, right? And so there's so many communities that are just essentially invisible because their biggest oppression is not their sexuality. And so it's not often and always centered. And it's almost like, unless you're like at Pride with rainbows everywhere, that like, that's the only way to be queer. You know, I have some friends, I'm trying to keep confidentiality, but like one person there, cis males, and one person is Muslim, one is not, but they're like not out because, I mean, people know, but it's like very different because of kind of the culture there, right? And that's just how it is, right? And then, but there's also like a very big gay scene in Dearborn, which is the largest Arab population, right, in the country. So it's just different. I think under the queer side, especially the focus on trans folks, right? Because there's a lot of cis folks that are TERFs, like J.K. Rowling, SWERFs, etc. And, you know, so I think that the difference is you have reformist feminism is the LGBTQ prong, and then you have revolutionary feminism, which is the queer prong, right? And that's where we want to abolish these systems, because this whole country was created off of like a farce, a real farce, right? The Declaration of Independence says merciless Indian savages in our Declaration of Independence, right? Look at all of our founding papers. I mean, it was founded by enslavers and people committing genocide. Like, what's there to reform?
Yeah.
Right. And so we are building a new world because that's what's happening. And, you know, the goal is to build it all fresh. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't reform this. And so, yeah, I think the queer world is much more abolition centered. I mean, you'll even see with Palestine, right? There's like so many queer folks are like advocating for justice in Palestine, whereas the LGBTQ folks are like, oh, your heads would be rolling if you're queer. Like, I think Amy Schumer said something like this, or Deborah Messing, or one of them, you know, like, oh, if you're in Palestine, they'd cut your heads off and kick your head if you were gay, you know? And all those tropes are on that side, again, just very much because that side's much more centered on whiteness.
Right. Yeah.
You made me very excited for the revolution. Like,
yeah,
what can happen, and like, yeah, like, abolishing just everything.
I think people are scared of that word, you know. It's a love revolution. Like, say whatever you want, but we have to. I mean, we are in late stage feminism.
I guess you could say that too. Might be that also. We kind of are.
Yes. But we are in late stage capitalism. And I mean, like, it's look at groceries. It's ridiculous. I've never seen these prices, right? We're like, we're all trying to survive under racial capitalism right now. And so, you know, as we build towards the next world, we really need to build a much, much larger movement of folks, like abolitionist folks, who are willing to build together. And like, I feel like the public needs to understand organizing strategies better, because there's such a disconnect, right, between like the civil rights lawyers, and then there's disconnect with organizers and activists, and the work right now is just building coalitions, a lot of intersectional coalitions. And again, I think, you know, some folks side-eye places like Instagram or digital advocacy, etc. But I think these are the spaces where a lot of these intersections happen. And actually, the Arab Spring was started by a woman named Asma Mahfouz on Twitter. And there was like some peer-reviewed article out there somewhere about how during the Arab Spring, a lot of like women were organizing on their computers, because because of that society, they might not be able to go outside because of something called Parda. So there was like a lot of activism in these societies. It was all on the internet and organizing. So, you know, I think we just have to think about a lot of these ideas differently. It's a very expansive, dreamy time, but also practical, you know. And I really like the both and, because I think it's important to balance both of those sides.
Yeah, I think it definitely makes activism more accessible for people who wouldn't otherwise have access to it. And then it also made me think of the bell hooks quote that you said earlier about pop culture. If you see like social media as like an extension of that pop culture, so it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you two are this too. We're storytellers. We're telling our stories in an authentic way, right? In order to shift culture and shift the narratives. And it's working. I mean, look at what's happening with Palestine. Like 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was organizing for Palestine, it was not like this.
No.
You would definitely have gotten fired from most of these nonprofit jobs if you spoke out, you know, like, well, not when I was at the Muslim org, that's different. But yeah, so I think it's working. I think there's a lot of downfalls of the internet, but there's also a lot of great things, obviously.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. And yeah. Also, when you said people are afraid of the word revolution, my first thought was, I'm afraid of what happens if we don't have that. Like, what's going to happen to us? What's going to happen to our communities and the world and other like marginalized communities if there is no revolution? So I think people who are afraid of that and like what comes with that phrase, there's so much violence and horror and all these horrible things happening without that. So it's like,
I mean, we were just talking about this in class because actually the topic this week in class was old versus new racism. And so, like I had said earlier, you know, 2043 is really the year that this big demographic shift is going to happen. And it really started in 1965, because before 1965, there was a barred Asiatic zone. Asians weren't allowed in the country, right? A lot of other countries were allowed in for the first time, really because of Black women and femmes in the South, not Martin Luther King, right? They were organizing against the systematic rape of Black women and femmes by white men when they were domestic workers, etc. And that's why the Immigration Act was passed, which is what brought my family here, you know? And so since that time, immigration trends, it's like, if you look at a graph, it's like for like BIPOC folks, right? It was like this, 1920s, there was a dip, and then all of a sudden 1965, and so 2043 is going to be a real moment. And if you actually study history and cycles, because everything cycles, right? It's like evidence-based. Yeah, there's going to be, I don't want to say what some folks say, but sometimes you have to, that there's a lot of foreshadowing of the next civil war. And people on the right, like Trump and all of them, they talk about it openly, right? They talk about the great replacement theory and blah, blah, blah. Democrats are just ignoring it, which is like, completely ignoring it, not talking about it. That's why everyone was so blindsided when Trump won, where some of us are like, Hillary's not going to win. And everyone's like, stop dying us, you know, because heads are in the sand and they're not actually looking at the evidence that's out there. And yeah, I don't know how it's going to come to head, but I think that's why a lot of us are really organizing to build larger coalitions and much larger movement for justice, right? And these movements are so centered in love, right? Abolition is love. That's what this is centered on. And how do I explain it? It's just, we have to, what the world needs now, sweet love, like power to the people, right? Like that's what love to the people. It's revolutionary and radical love, and that also, and I think it's like abolition principles help with that, in the way that the folks are like, well, what about the murders and the rapists, you know, like what do you do with them if you don't believe in jail? And it's like, well, let's think about this together collectively, like you've sent people to the moon. Like, there's lots of ways, I mean, there's lots of examples of what other countries have done, etc. And that's why we have to do all this work now, right? Because 2043 is coming, and we really need to be like organized and build together. And I always say shame is the worst organizing strategy. Like this idea of like shaming, like check your privilege, or like what's the other thing that happens? Just like people use the word should, like you should. I can't stand the word should. Although I'm sure I use it. Just my mom.
But you shouldn't.
But the word I try to stop saying you should. Yeah. It's something I'm working on. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much kind of, from the Democrats specifically, so much arrogance and condescension, right? That pushes folks away. But in the end, they're not the folks, like, I wish I could draw you this organizing circle that kind of shows that, like, we're not trying to focus on the like January 6th folks, the like fascist white supremacists, trying to work with like the folks on the edge, you know, there's like all these organizing strategies and
the ones who are moldable.
Moldable, but yeah, well, it's, I don't know if it's moldable.
You can move the needle.
Yeah. Open to listening. Like, it's really hard for folks to hear anything that's critical of racial capitalism, right? Neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. It's like folks want to keep everything, but it's like no one needs like 50 types of cereal in you know, the grocery store. I remember every time I used to come back, I mean, still, every time I come back from Gujarat, from India, I go through like a 3-week depression because you just look around, you're like, how is there so much gluttony and so much greed? Mm-hmm. People do not need this much.
Mm-hmm.
It is, there's so much waste. Like, go to these all you can eat buffets, and it's like, what is, they're just like, you know, dropping bags of flour in other parts of the world, and there's so much waste. And it's just because that's part of the ethos, right? Just take individual, which is like community is the antidote. Community, you were asking earlier, what do? You build community because we need community care. Mutual aid funds, donate to your local mutual aid fund, because this is how someone, especially like, you know, trans folks of color specifically, like, I need a month's rent. You'll get it from a mutual aid fund. Like, build those, you know, they were really gaining steam in the 60s and 70s. And that's why Reagan just tried to like cut them, because it was bringing liberation. So, you know, community, the local, hyper local is the best place to start. You know, you say hyper, hyper local, and you build, and then you build, and you build in so many ways. Maybe it's a protest here, maybe it's a community dinner, but we need each other in that way, right? In all these old countries that many of us come from, that's the biggest culture shock, is that usually like a whole families live on the same street and compounds. Like, you don't have to worry about babysitters. Mm-hmm. Auntie will get them. And here you're doing it all alone. Mm-hmm. And that's this hyper late stage capitalism. It's not sustainable. People feel more alone than they ever have, right? Because the structure needs to change.
Yeah.
We need each other.
Yeah. Fully agree.
Absolutely. I feel like I could listen to you talk for so much longer, but I do want to ask kind of our last question. Sure. If you have any advice for young queer people, or like advice you wish you had gotten when you were younger, you know, anything that you would tell the queer youths of today.
Well, I'm going to specifically speak to queer Muslim youth, because I think it's.
Yes. I was going to ask you if after that, I was going to say, can we talk to queer Muslim youth and do anything? Mm-hmm. So that's great.
Well, and you know, the reason I'm saying that is because I get like DMs on the side often, and it'll be like someone who's like 15 and, you know, about how it feels like so healing to come to the site and see someone that has like views on this Instagram, etc. And I literally, it's like, it's healing for me to create this space, because it's what I dreamed I would have wanted.
Yeah.
And so, and that didn't exist, again, because 1965 Immigration Act, there were not a lot of people like us then. Like, I was part of that first group. And so we're building all the infrastructure right now, right? For folks who are younger. And it feels so liberatory. It feels really healing and joyful. And I just get so excited when I'm connected to someone else, and, you know, we'll just randomly be in the same city. We'll go out, you know, to dinner, drinks, whatever. And so I think what I would say is, you're lucky, because the internet was not around when I was younger. We were still like writing exams during college. And like, I would just say, like, connect on these spaces, places like Queer Crescent, places like Heart Women and Girls, which is a reproductive justice organization, right? If you have, I think there's various mutual aid funds if you need an abortion and you're a woman, etc. There's a lot of support out there in a way that there never was before. Mm-hmm. My page, PR to the People, is very much like a curated page centering this community. So when there's events, et cetera, I'm always posting in my stories, et cetera, you know, because it's just super, super, super exciting to build together and build this community, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We were, the next question was actually going to be, can you let our listeners know where to find you? So all of it will be on PR to the People.
Yep. PR to the People. There's links in there to some articles, et cetera. I haven't had time to write as much on the site, which is why I say we irregularly publish, but some other folks are joining soon and hopefully they're, you know, it's just, it's a lot. It's, but it's exciting work, and it just takes time and around raising a kid and teaching et cetera, right?
But I have
to do this. This is literally my hobby. It's like it's in my stomach, and it's just like I have to get this stuff out, you know, and so it's just, it doesn't feel like work at all. And I just, clearly it makes me happy. Right? Like for the last 10 years, I was a lawyer and everyone, like all my friends, everyone around me is just like, you are such a different person. I'm glowing now that I'm not practicing law and I'm working on this stuff, you know, it's just, it's so amazing. So PR to the People is the best place to find me. I'm not on X, Twitter, all that stuff. I'm just on one site because my anxiety will go everywhere if I'm all over the place.
Right. So and Instagram is the
Instagram. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Instagram. Yeah. PYAAR to the People. Some people spell PR PYAR. So
okay.
Yeah, but you know, if you liked anything or connected with anything from this podcast, like feel free to DM me, especially if you happen to be a queer Muslim and you're like, what, you know, you know, we are, there's so many, there's like online spaces, prayer, the khutbahs for Ramadan for queer Muslims, right? Mm-hmm. There's like a lot of spaces that you can just like plug into if you don't have folks in your town. And that's really, really exciting. And, you know, because again, there's so much that's beautiful in this culture, in this world, that's like, you rarely see it on TV because of the hegemony, right? Because that's a whole other story, but there's so much that like many of us still want to preserve. And so, you know, I mean, look at all the djinns, so many gender neutral djinns, and like, there's just, you know, there's been queer sex in Islam. Go look at Sufism from like, I don't know, 1500s. Look at all those pictures. Like, there's so much. And I'm really, really like, I center myself in Sufism and mysticism, which is not like, folks think it's watered down, like Rumi, which is not necessarily true. But it is mystic, right? It's saying like, I don't need to go to Mecca. Mecca's in your heart, things of that nature. And I could talk about this forever. I mean, I could talk about something that's kind of like so sacrilegious, which is that I wear this ring, which is the moon and star facing. But Islam, the symbol in Islam is that way, right? The crescent, moon, and star. This symbol was the symbol for Alat. She was the moon goddess before Islam came, you know, pre-Islamic Arabia. And there was Manat and Al-Uzza. And there's all these interstices of the Quran, because I believe that all these books were written by Ben. Like, I don't care about the books, really. I just, like, look for meanings. And there's this part in the Quran that says, remember Alat, Manat, and Al-Uzza. And the reason is that's how they were converting folks. But when people go to Mecca and circumambulate seven times, they did that for Alat. And the stone, the black stone in the Kaaba, was that stone, right? From the moon goddess. And so I very much like relate to Alat. And then the name was masculinized to Allah, right? And there's like all this, like for me, it's very much like the witchy earth.
Yeah.
Like kind of the earth-based aspect. Like I love bowing my head and touching the ground and all of that. So again, it's like, I feel like one of the only spaces I can like talk about this expansively, and everyone's like, yeah, it's like these queer Muslim spaces, you know?
Yeah. 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 They're so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing everything that you had to say with us. And I just feel like I've learned so much. And I think, like Cheyenne said, your students must just be like soaking up so much. So that's awesome.
I be sure if you want to read about the reproductive rights versus reproductive justice, you can go to PRtothepeople.com.
Nice to meet you as well. For our listeners, y'all already know where to find us everywhere. Sapphic Survival Guide, except for X, which is just Sapphic Survival. Send us questions via email, DMs. We are sapphicsurvivalguide@gmail.com. And we've got Patreon content at patreon.com/sapphicsurvivalguide. And you can follow me anywhere online at The Libra Gina, including my website, thelibragina.com.
And you can find me, Cheyenne, at Hot Mess Ban on pretty much any social media platform. And with that, class is now dismissed.